This is Wolf's Campfire, and you're about to listen to Three Scary Serial Killer Encounters, Volume 5. You can also check me out on YouTube at youtube.com/wolfscampfire. Now with that said, whether you're sitting around a campfire, on the night shift, or even laying in bed, let my voice soothe your nightmares. There's a serial killer on the loose, written by Rex Featherstone.
No matter what, I could always count on my friend Lewis. This had been true throughout middle school, high school, and it was especially true now. I was an actor living in Los Angeles. I consider the first 7 years of my career to have been successful. I landed parts in theater, commercials, independent films, and even a reoccurring role on a TV show for cable. I was by no means a star, but I made enough money to live comfortably in my apartment without the need for a roommate. However, during the 8th year, things took a turn for the worse. The TV show I was on got canceled, and for some reason, it was becoming increasingly difficult for me to find new parts. I had no other option but to find a roommate. This did not take long, and it did help me for a little while. But despite my prayers, things didn't improve. I began to look around for any survival jobs that I could take temporarily. But I was unable to find anything that would sufficiently pay my rent. So, eventually, I had to leave. That's when I called Lewis. Lewis and I had known each other since 7th grade. We went to the same community college, but we both dropped out after the first semester to move to LA to pursue acting careers. After 2 years of no luck, Lewis gave up and moved to Nevada, and became a TSA agent. I spoke on the phone with him occasionally, but we were nowhere near as close as we used to be. I almost reconsidered reaching out to him. My fingers were trembling as I dialed his phone number. Once he answered, I decided to start by asking him how he was. After a few minutes of small talk, I went for it. I asked him if I could come out and stay with him. He was silent. The question clearly caught him off guard. "Really?" he said incredulously. "Yes," I replied. I went on to explain to him my predicament. He went quiet once again. After a few seconds of consideration, he agreed to let me come and stay with him at his house. 2 days later, I was filling my tank with gas and drove out to Boulder City, Nevada. I felt bad for my roommate, as I was abandoning him just a week after inviting him to live with me. But I reassured myself that he would have no trouble finding someone new to help him pay the rent. I arrived at Lewis's house that evening. He welcomed me with open arms, gave me a tour of his house, and introduced me to his pet cat, Randall. He then showed me to his guest room. That night, we ordered a pizza and caught up as we ate. We spent time reflecting on our lives, reminding each other of memories from our childhood, whether they be funny or sad, or shocking. I told him all about the show that I had been on. He had heard about it from me before, but never got around to watching it. Just before I was going to head off to bed, Lewis took on a serious tone. "Peter," he said solemnly. "What is it?" I inquired. He sighed and then continued. "People have been murdered in this town recently." I gasped. "By who?" Lewis shrugged. "No one knows." I asked him how many people had been murdered at that point. 2 so far. A woman, a few blocks down, and a man just up the street. They were decapitated. I've been keeping the doors and windows locked. I want you to make sure it stays that way, especially at night. I nodded. "Well, on that happy note," I said sarcastically, "I'm gonna slip off to bed." A week later, I managed to find a local restaurant that was in need of a waiter. I gladly took the job. I barely had any money now, and I wanted to at least be able to pay for my own food while I was staying with Lewis. My shift lasted from 2 o'clock to 10 o'clock, which was when the restaurant closed, meaning I was driving home at night. This made me nervous. I made sure to not make any stops. I became more comfortable with this over time. 3 weeks had passed, and there hadn't been any new murders. That is, until one night. I was driving home later than usual. I had gotten caught up in a conversation with one of my coworkers who, like me, was an ardent movie enthusiast. We got so caught up talking about what the next Quentin Tarantino film might be that we both completely lost track of time. I was just a couple of blocks away from Lewis's house, listening to the radio and thinking about my recent conversation when I heard a sound that made me jump, a scream. This wasn't a scream of excitement or surprise. This was a scream of absolute terror. It sounded nearby, so I slammed the brakes and looked around. It didn't take me long to notice the brick house to my left. On the wall was a 5x5-foot glass window, which allowed me to see into the kitchen. I saw the terrified young woman who stood by the window. "No, please!" she cried. A man wearing a black jacket and a red mask came into view, holding a fire axe. He ran up to the woman and immediately struck her with it, and she fell to the floor. He stared down at her for a moment, then slowly turned his head and looked right in my direction. I slammed my foot down on the acceleration. I raced back to Lewis's house and burst through the front door. I saw Lewis sitting at the dinner table, eating a bowl of chili. He instantly noticed my state of distress. "What's wrong?" he asked. "We need to call the police," I yelled. Lewis got to his feet. "Why?" "Because a woman just got killed." His eyes widened. "Oh my God." He pulled out his phone, and minutes later, the police arrived. I showed them to the woman's house, where they found the body in the kitchen. Her head had been completely removed, and was nowhere to be found. I then gave them a description of the masked figure I saw. They searched the entire neighborhood, but failed to show up with anything. Lewis and I returned home. Once we ascertained that everything was locked, we went to bed. I never fell asleep, though, and I spent the entire night tossing and turning, trying to rid my mind of what I had seen, but it was impossible. The next afternoon, I was getting ready to leave for work, and I was exhausted, and even considered calling in sick that day, but this was not an option. I needed to make all the money I could if I had any desire to resume living independently. I grabbed my phone and car keys and walked to the front door. The moment I put my hand on the doorknob, I heard a sound from the back of the house. It was the sound of something falling on the floor. The time was about 1:45. Lewis usually came home around then, but his car wasn't parked outside, and I could think of no reason why he would come in through the back door. "Lewis?" I called, but received no answer. I became nervous and wanted to leave, but I was too curious, too invested in what the cause of this noise might have been. I slowly walked back through the kitchen, as I called Lewis's name, but again, no response. I reached the end of the kitchen, where there was a turning point that led into the living room. I had a view of the back door, and it was closed. I stepped into the living room and looked around. It didn't take me long to realize what the source of the noise was. Against the wall were several stacks of cardboard boxes. One box lay upside down on the floor. I assumed it must have fallen off. Just as I turned my back to the room, I heard another sound. The sound of something moving inside the collection of boxes. I whirled around just in time to see the boxes disperse and something jump out at me. I breathed a sigh of relief when I saw that it was only Randall, Lewis's cat. I chuckled to myself, feeling stupid for not having considered this possibility sooner. I looked up from the floor, and that's when I saw it. The boxes had been covering a wooden door on the wall. I thought I had seen the entire house. Apparently not. Again, my curiosity got the better of me, and I sauntered through the pile of boxes over to the door. I opened it, revealing a concrete staircase leading to a dark basement. I remembered Lewis had specifically told me that the house was only one story, and I believed him. I had no reason not to. I found a light switch and turned on a single bulb at the bottom of the staircase, then began making my way down the steps. I had to know what was down there. As soon as I reached the bottom, my heart skipped a beat. There was a small shelf rack against the back wall. The top shelf was the only one that appeared to have anything on it, and there was just enough light for me to see what it was. Human heads. 3 of them. The one on the right end belonged to the woman I had seen murdered the previous night. At that moment, my entire body went numb, and I needed to get out of there. I ran back up the stairs and into the kitchen. Looking back, I could have gone out the back door, which was conveniently just a matter of feet from the basement. But I was too overwhelmed to even consider this at the time. When I got back into the kitchen, as if on cue, the front door opened, and Lewis walked inside, and I stood still. "Didn't expect you to still be here," he said, once he saw me. He stared at me. I was in sheer petrification. No amount of acting training could help me conceal the fear that overtook me. Lewis knew instantly what had happened. I could see it in his eyes. "What's wrong, Peter?" he asked, as he began walking towards me. I was silent. "What's wrong, Peter?" he said again, as he snatched a knife from the wood block on the counter. I tried to run, but by now, it was too late. He grabbed my arm and slammed me up against the refrigerator. He held his blade inches from my throat. "You found my trophies, didn't you?"
I won't tell anyone," I said. "I swear."
This was an obvious lie. "I didn't want to kill you," he bellowed. "You shouldn't have gone down there." I looked to my left to see a can of Windex lying on a small table. I managed to grab it and immediately sprayed it in Lewis's face. He dropped the knife to the floor and clasped his hands over his eyes, screaming in pain. I ran out of there and over to the neighbor's house. I began pounding on the door and a woman answered.
"Your phone!"
I yelled.
"I need to use your phone!"
The woman obliged. 5 minutes later, police officers came to the house and arrested Lewis. Day later, found a red mask in his closet. I am living with my cousin in Missouri now. This is not ideal, as it's very far from Los Angeles, but I'm hoping to get a new job and make enough money to move back out of there. I made my cousin show me every square inch of his house to make sure there was no decapitated heads hidden anywhere. I haven't had a good night's sleep in days. Whenever I try to sleep, I always find myself thinking about Lewis. I still cannot believe that my best friend, since middle school, had murdered 3 people. I've been pondering why he might have done it. Perhaps he was sour after having failed as an actor. I tried to think, is any subtle signs of insanity that Lewis had shown over the years? Nothing came to mind, but there's one thought that bothers me more than any other. This is the thought that keeps me awake at night. The man who I had been seen killing that woman couldn't have been Lewis. With the speed at which I was driving, there was no way he could have beat me back to his house, much less have had time to hide everything. Get his chili out of the refrigerator, heat it up, and then start eating it. The more I think about it, the more anxious I become. I've tried to lie to myself and believe that everything is fine now, but deep down, I know the truth. Lewis has an accomplice.
My old best friend is a crazy serial killer. I'm his next victim. Written by Phone User 1243.
I met Michael when I was in middle school. At the middle school I went to, lots of kids would poke fun at me for being chubby. Michael was a bit older than me and was quite popular, so I never knew why he wanted to befriend me. As he yelled, "Hey!" everyone recognized who he was and practically ran out of the cafeteria. He was also a strong person, so I knew why they were terrified when he was shouting. I sat at my lunch table, completely oblivious to why everyone ran away. Michael sat next to me and gave me a compliment. Next thing I know, we were having small talk at first, and it eventually grew into us becoming best friends. Everyone now got jealous of me because of my new friend. Michael told me to never listen to people who talk negatively to me. From then on, he was my role model. I would usually find him in the cafeteria, where he would usually sit next to me. Now, I was 24 years old. I have a loving wife and twins on the way. Also, in the past 4 years, I never met Michael again. I was a bit sad when I never saw him anymore, but then again, he might have already had something better to do. Well, it was 12 a.m. when I heard something breaking upstairs. I told my wife about it. but she was always a deep sleeper, so she didn't respond. I grabbed my phone, turned it on, and went upstairs. I had to tiptoe up the flight of stairs as it could be an intruder. I checked the room that would soon be our twins' room, and found the window broken. I was shocked until I heard footsteps going downstairs. I was literally sweating at the thought that the intruder would go to our room and probably shoot my wife. I ran down the stairs and went to the kitchen to grab a weapon. The old frying pan was the only thing I could find, as we have loads of cabinets in the kitchen, and I already forgot where we put the knives. The intruder must have heard me, as I heard more footsteps heading to the kitchen. I hid beneath the counter just as the person turned on the lights. Its footsteps were getting closer, and I was holding onto the frying pan, trying not to hit it against the counter. My thoughts soon consumed me of every possible situation, and in every one of them, I got killed. After what felt like an hour, I heard the footsteps heading outside the kitchen. I slowly got behind him and realized that I might want to think of a different approach, as there could be more than one of them. He was holding a blood-stained knife, which made me angry and sad about the thought he or she might have already killed my wife. Because of those thoughts, I hit him so hard as he fell to the ground. He wore a mask, and when I removed it, I saw Michael's face. Disbelief and pure rage consumed me, and the thought of always to get revenge. I tied him up with my skipping rope and put him in the closet. I then called 911 and explained the situation. They asked who the person was, and I said that his name was Michael Roberts. The person on the other line was confused and said that this clearly was a prank call. I asked what makes it feel like a prank call, in which they responded that Michael Roberts died from a car crash years ago. I immediately hung up and ran to the closet. I put Michael in, and I found my wife's severed head with a note attached to it. I slowly took it and read the note. It said, "Let's play hide and seek, like old times. I'll be the seeker. Let's begin."
A serial killer is on the loose in California, and they hunt vigilantes. Written by Midnight Author.
A serial killer has been hunting vigilantes in California, and they have already racked up 3 victims that we know of. The killer is crafty, cunning, and leaves no trace. They corner their victims, take them out quickly, and leave nothing but a king playing card with a large red X drawn onto it. Victim number 1 was Hugh Muniz, aka Golden Eagle. Golden Eagle was a vigilante who worked out of Los Angeles. He was a former Army Reserve turned paramedic. But when he wasn't out saving lives, he was, well, saving lives just in a costume. He wore a ridiculous golden chainmail costume with a large eagle-like cowl and golden wings that seemed to be completely cosmetic. He carried 2 smaller batons on his person and a beanbag shotgun, which he sparsely used unless completely necessary. Golden Eagle wasn't a big vigilante, but he didn't go around fighting drug kingpins or over-the-top villains. He mostly did small stuff like stopping carjackings, assaults, and small-time drug deals. That wasn't to say he did his job completely unharmed. The coroner noted that he had many scars on his body that seemed to be inflicted from past stabbings and shootings. Golden Eagle was not afraid to get hurt, to help people, and ultimately, that is what cost him his life. His body was found in the early morning hours in an alleyway by a garbage man. He was lying down in a pool of his own blood, and he had been shot execution style in the back of the head. Beside him was the king card and a dirty old baby doll with an audio player taped to its body. When the audio was played, it broadcasted a loud recording of the baby crying. It became obvious that this was not a job gone wrong for Golden Eagle. Rather, he had been lured here by the killer and assassinated when he let his guard down to check on the faux baby. Hugh Muniz was 37 years old and leaves behind 2 daughters. 2 weeks passing with no leads meant no sleep for me. Diners consisted of Shake Shack or whatever my husband Michael left out for me to heat up. Cases like these always brought a lot of stress to me. They pulled me away from my family and aged me at a rate no 38-year-old man wants. My jet-black hair was already graying, and every time I washed my face, I could spot another wrinkle. Nobody likes working late, but the difference between a detective staying late and an office worker staying late is if an office worker doesn't stay late, some profits could be lost. If a detective doesn't stay late, another person loses their life and another person did. Roller Bell was her alias, but we would learn afterwards her real name was Emily Howard, a 25-year-old childcare worker and roller derby champion. Roller Bell was a type of celebrity vigilante. She did the crime fighting, but she also showed her face at charity events, and she was even a mascot for a domestic abuse organization after she blew up in popularity when someone recorded her beating up a man who had knocked two women unconscious outside a nightclub. Roller Bell swooped in wearing a cheerleader's costume, a pair of roller skates, and a purple sequined luchadora mask while carrying a baseball bat covered in various stickers including a Hello Kitty sticker and a baby metal sticker. She put a beating on that dude and it turned her into a star. I'm talking interviews, TV appearances, magazine covers, and she even had a skin added to a mobile MMO. She didn't fit the bill of the hypermasculine bravado that most vigilantes carried. She was friendly, cute, and innocent, and the media loved it. I met her once at San Diego Comic-Con, the year Michael and I brought our son Martin, and she was so amazing towards him and every other kid there. He absolutely adored her. Coming home that next morning, after we found her body, and telling him that she had died was the toughest thing I've ever had to do as a father. He exploded into tears, darted into his room, and didn't come out for the rest of the day. This was what heroes like Roller Bell meant to people. She was a symbol of hope and goodness in the world, and some psychopath wiped that out. She was found similarly to Golden Eagle. She had been tricked into a phony situation, deceived into saving a civilian in peril who didn't exist. People nearby reported a woman crying and screaming for help nearby before a colorful figure skated down the alley. That figure was Roller Bell, and moments later, she would be stabbed 17 times and left to die in a pool of her own blood. Again, the X'd out king card was left beside her body, and again, there was no other evidence. This one really hurt people. Golden Eagle was a nice guy, and he brought an important service to his city, but he was mostly unknown outside of his community. Roller Bell was a star who reached many more lives. Some videos of her in action had millions of views online. It's sad to say, but the further reach you have, the more people that are affected by your death. The death of Roller Bell saw a ramp up in the investigation. No longer could it be chalked up as a lone killing of a vigilante. Now, we had definitive proof that there was a serial killer on the loose. With their next killing, they showed us how dangerous they really were. Golden Eagle and Roller Bell were both skilled, and they knew how to look after themselves, but in terms of vigilanteism, they were both relatively small fry, stopping assaults and robberies mostly. Goliath the Gunner, however, was about as dangerous as you can get, wearing a full body suit of steel-plated armor and carrying a battalion of weapons including handguns, shotguns, assault rifles, and even a light machine gun. Basically, whatever he needs for the job at hand. Goliath first popped up in Stockton over 12 years ago, but he has been terrorizing mobsters all over California for a decade. He is a complete nutcase and rarely leaves any survivors when he shows up on a scene. While people like Golden Eagle and Roller Bell were examples of the good vigilantes can do in their communities, Goliath the Gunner was the epitome of all that was wrong with the concept. He was a skilled and deadly maniac with questionable morals who believed he was above the law. I've heard many stories of cops attempting to apprehend him, only for them to end up spending the night in an ICU. He has had thousands of dollars worth of rewards put on his head over the years, but none have ever been cashed, and those that sought out the reward only received a bullet from Goliath himself. Nobody could kill him. Almost nobody. Goliath had an Achilles heel in his armor, a small gap on each side between the shoulders and the neck. And that is exactly where the killer shot him, lacerating both external carotid arteries and leaving him to drown in his own blood on the side of a road in Vallejo. An X'd out king card placed gently on his chest plate. The killing of Goliath the Gunner, only days after the death of Roller Bell, pushed further resources to the investigation, and now a murder had occurred outside LA, meaning This was now a cross-department and cross-city investigation. The killer was gaining confidence, and they had begun to hunt more and more challenging targets. They did their research, they learned their target's weaknesses, and they struck unexpectedly. I considered myself to be a great detective, but I had never met a suspect so shrewd and skilled, and it terrified me. I had already mentioned my lack of sleep, but I had also begun to question my decisions and even doubt my ability to catch the killer. I doubted anyone's ability. I sat in an office in the precinct eating a bowl of ready noodles and staring at hordes of files and loose papers on potential suspects. Linked cases and unsolved murders. I felt like smashing my head against a desk, but instead opted to lightly tap my forehead off of it and exhale loudly as the door to the office creaked open. I lifted my head to see a uniformed rookie officer standing in the doorway. I had seen her around a few times, but for the life of me, I couldn't remember her name. "Detective Clements, sir. Detective Moltisanti asked me to get you," she said with a soft southern twang to her vernacular. "There's been another murder."
"What? Where? Who's the victim?"
I asked, while jumping out of my seat and bolting out of the door, my energy rejuvenated by the news. I ran out of the office and into the hallways, followed closely behind by the rookie, who attempted to keep up with me and answer my question.
"Ricky Starr, sir. The murder, it was,
she replied.
"It was streamed."
The shock I had felt from the news of another slaying had transformed into an abject horror. This psycho was getting enough headlines from their actions, and now the whole world has video of them in action. Ricky Starr was a vigilante in his early 20s, unlike other vigilantes. He never hid his identity or his face. He used his popularity as a former child actor to create an online following for his YouTube channel, where he posted vlogs, training videos, and tutorials for self-defense. Ricky was one of the best Asian American creators on the platform, and thanks to his black belt in Kung Fu, Karate, Taekwondo, and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, he had an expertise that many others simply didn't. Combine this with his over-the-top personality, and equally over-the-top good looks, and you had a recipe for success. Once his fanbase had grown enough, he started his own website, where he would post extra content, including a nightly stream, where he would patrol the streets of LA, donning a skin-fit red Kevlar rash guard with a golden star that included the letters RS, stitched into the chest, a pair of black combat pants, and custom red and black sneakers. Ricky, with help from his cameraman Bradley, would livestream himself out and about the LA streets stopping crime, whether that was breaking up a fight, calming down some drunks, or stopping a robbery. Ricky often got physical with assailants on these streams, but he was never the instigator. As you can imagine, he never had much trouble with the people he fought, including a 4-on-1 fight against a gang who had been attempting to rob a 7-Eleven. Ricky's streams were very popular in the precinct, and I know many officers here are fans of the guy, and his bombastic attitude. When I finally reached the main area of the building, a crowd of uniformed and non-uniformed cops were swarmed around one desk. In the middle was a detective, Ricky Moltisanti, a 20-year veteran of the force and a good friend of mine.
"What's going on, Rick?"
I inquired as I walked up to the busy desk.
"It ain't good, Ryan. That Star kid is dead, and the killer, he spoke,"
Ricky replied to me, a hint of despair emanating from his often calm and collected voice.
"What? What do you mean he spoke? To who, and what did he say?"
I confusingly asked, feeling like some sort of game show host with an array of questions I dropped on him. He didn't bother to tackle any of them. Instead, just telling me to look and instructing the detective whose desk we were congregated at to play it from the start. The crowd stepped aside and allowed me to get close to the monitor as the clip from the stream began to play. It was Ricky walking down an almost empty street as he spoke to the fans on stream.
"It's been a quiet one tonight, my stars. It doesn't make for the most exciting stream, but it is great news for our community, and it shows that what myself and other heroes and the police force are doing is working," he said. "We'll do a few more patrols and see what happens, but it could be an early night tonight. If it is, well, we'll head back to the Star Cove and do a Q&A and some fun tricks and stunts.
Ricky continued on through the street for another few moments before some screams could be heard in the distance, followed by a man demanding money as a woman screamed for help and begged for the man to get off of her. Ricky instantly sprung into action and sprinted towards the supposed crime. The camera shook and became distorted as Bradley failed to keep up with Ricky.
"Hurry up, Bradley! God, you better not miss this shot up like last weekend."
Once Ricky reached the alley that the sound was coming from, he stopped in his tracks as he saw absolutely nothing was there. No damsel in distress, and there was no brooding criminal. However, the screams of a woman and demands of the man could still be heard. Ricky tracked the noise further into the alley, before picking up a small speaker from the ground and holding it to the camera.
"Well, gang, looks like someone has played quite the prank on us tonight. At least we got some cardio in,"
he jovially proclaimed, attempting to brush the situation off as a simple prank. Though, behind him in the darkness, a shadowy figure could be seen. It stepped forward to reveal a tall man wearing a hooded shawl and a mask, pulling a stainless steel pistol out.
"Ricky, watch out!"
Bradley screamed, but it was too late. As Ricky began to turn, the man shot, and the bullet lodged in the side of his head. Ricky Starr slumped to the floor before Bradley dropped the camera and ran for his life. The camera lay on the ground of the alley, focused on Ricky's twitching arm. A large boot stepped between the camera and Ricky before the camera was lifted from the ground and held up by the killer, pointing it towards himself. He had pulled his hood down to fully reveal his mask. It was an all-black mask of a skull, which covered up to his nose and over his eyes. His forehead was both covered in a black substance to camouflage himself further. The mask had shiny silver teeth, and both jaws were covered in intricate embossed spirals and swirls. The eyes on the mask were covered with black mirrored glass, which reflected an image of the camera in his hands. The killer breathed heavily for a moment before broadcasting his message to the world in a rough and distorted voice.
"If you kill a god, they cease to be one. If you kill a king, they become only bone. Embrace regicide."